You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.
We're very privileged this morning to have Dr. Robin Hennell. He is an economist and the author of Economic Justice and Democracy. Thank you so much for joining us.
With you this morning.
We are at a point in society where inequality has reached such level that it should almost be, in my opinion, a no-brainer that we need a transformation. The impact that this has on our environment, on the mass displacement of people as millions are pushed into misery and extreme poverty. We know now that every day 35,000 children die of hunger worldwide. We know that we are spending more in military spending than we have ever in the history of our society, and that, you know, many of the things that face us are being ignored by our governments. So I think it's important to understand how these policies are put in place. And as an economist, I wonder if you could comment on the role of the international debt and how that debt is maintained and supported by policies of institutions like the IMF.
Yes, Sylvia, when economic historians write about this period of economic history, the last 30 years, the thing that they will write in their history books that's most noticeable is that the increase in global inequality of income and wealth during these 30 years is the most spectacular rate of increase of inequality, economic inequality, that the world has ever seen. The second thing that they will write about is how in the global capitalist economy, productive businesses basically became beholden to financial corporations. That this is a period when the rise of the power of the financial industry and financial corporations, not only at the expense of governments, unions, workers, consumers, but also their power has risen dramatically vis-a-vis industrial corporations. That's the other notable feature of the 30 years that we've been through. People can put a name on it, free market capitalism, neoliberal capitalism. That's been the trend. That's been the model. And that model has now reached a real crisis point. I think of all the possibilities that are out there, and some are far more favorable and optimistic than others, and there are some possibilities that are actually, you know, rather terrible things to contemplate. The one thing that's not possible, and this is where people like the Obama administration really make an incredible error, is simply putting the system we have been living under for 30 years, putting that Humpty Dumpty back together again, that's actually not in the cards. They're not going to be able to do that, and one of the major problems with Obama administration economics policy is it's essentially premised on the assumption that we can go back to where we were 5 or 6 years ago, both in the U.S. economy and the global economy, and do things in the same kind of way and have the same kind of outcomes. That's not going to happen.
I think understanding the structures that maintains the system that most people would argue it's inequitable and it's not in the interest of the majority of people needs to be understood in order for us to take action to transform it, dismantle, or create something in its place.
The International Monetary Fund is essentially a creditor's cartel for big international lenders. It operates as their agent in the same way that sort of kneecappers for the mafia operate in their lending operations. The IMF has essentially been transformed from an institution that was created in the aftermath of World War II by the Bretton Woods Agreement. At that point, its mandate was international finance really screwed up the global economy prior to the Great Recession, you know, prior to the Great Depression. And we don't want to see that happening again now that World War II is over. We need an agency that would essentially prevent international finance from messing up free market international finance, from messing up the global economy for the citizens of the world. That was its mandate. And you could argue that for maybe 10 to 15 to 20, even maybe 25 years, it performed in a way that was never entirely fair, but it basically carried that mandate out. Beginning at the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s, the INF was transformed into an institution that was basically functioning in an entirely different way. It was promoting the policies that served massive international lenders, and it was serving as the enforcer against debtor countries whenever they got into the predictable problems that the IMF policies were going to lead to.
In theory, though, the role of the IMF was one of using debt in order to make materials accessible for manufacturing, for countries to develop, right? That was the role of development,
yes,
as presented.
Now, this takes us to the second question, which is, well, is lending and borrowing always a bad thing? Do we want to have some sort of a credit system or do we not? And if we have a credit system, does that mean we have money? Does that mean we have banks? Does that mean we have regulation or we don't have regulation? I mean, these are the fundamental choices. And there's also an intellectual vacuum. Mainstream economics, you know, in the profession, as finance has been taught for 30 years, essentially it's been mistaught. When people have been teaching finance in our PhD programs in economics, and this is what's published and taught in the mainstream of the profession about finance, what they essentially have done is they have taught about the upside potential of credit and borrowing and lending, why it is that this function basically can play a potentially productive and useful function in our economies. What they have completely eliminated from the curriculum is something that was understood 40 years ago, which is there's also a downside potential to finance and credit systems that one must always be aware of and wary of.
Well, understanding, I think, the role that the IMF has played in concrete terms, in terms of the policies that it has implemented that have resulted in poverty, is one way, I think, of helping us create a better understanding. So when you talk about this system, you write about economic justice and democracy, and you describe structural adjustments as a major cause of poverty. Explain why this is the case. What does it mean?
Since the 1980s, the IMF has essentially promoted two kinds of policies. The first set of policies create the conditions, the predictable conditions, for a financial collapse for a small developing country. So the first problem is they're promoting policies that are laying the groundwork for a crisis, you know, in East Asia, a crisis in Argentina, a crisis in Brazil. Can you predict exactly when it will occur? Can you say which country will suffer this crisis first? No, that's very difficult. But can you predictably say that if you continue a certain set of policies, you will inevitably be generating periodic crises of the kind that we have had in the international economy, increasingly apparent since the mid-1990s. Well, what are those policies the IMF has pushed? The most dangerous one and the one that created the most damage is called capital liberalization. Essentially, they said, look, the old IMF system encouraged countries and even helped country governments put some sort of restrictions and limits on how rapidly international investment, financial capital for the most part, could flow into their economies and then be yanked out of their economy. Those are called capital controls. They were part of the original Bretton Woods IMF managed system. It was very wise because it recognized that relatively small, underdeveloped economies, if they are subjected to unregulated inflows of international financial capital and unregulated outflows, they are patients that will predictably suffer terrible consequences if they are allowed to exist in those circumstances. Well, the IMF turned around and seized upon a minor little point of sort of economic wisdom and said, you know, under certain conditions, allowing investment to flow wherever it wants produces efficiency gains. So we want to now encourage country governments to eliminate all these restrictions. There were economists who advised against this, and yet that was the trend. And that was the major policy that they pushed that was the enabling policy. Now, what inevitably happened after, and this was not just advice that was offered, The IMF operates where there are certain countries it doesn't even bother to give advice because everybody knows the country government would never pay any attention if it was contrary to anything that government wanted to do. The IMF has never given the U.S. government advice because that would be a joke. On the other hand, the IMF does give advice to third world countries, and it's because those third world countries basically are reliant on some of the services that the IMF provides and some of the services the IMF can deny them. The IMF, if you don't liberalize, if you don't engage in capital liberalization, the IMF can basically make it very, very difficult or impossible for you to get any sort of international loans on any sort of basis. So it was in a position where it wasn't just handing out free advice. It was literally twisting arms and blackmailing governments to engage in capital liberalization. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence that many governments resisted that, but were increasingly just sort of forced to comply. Now, what happens when you have an East Asian financial crisis that's produced mostly by unrestricted flows of capital in a world where you have an increasingly large pool of liquid mobile capital that can simply move in and out of economies at the whim? Well, the IMF then comes in and the country is in trouble. Its currency is collapsing. It's going into a major recession. And the IMF comes in and the country says, we need help. We now need help to basically stave off disaster. There's a bunch of loans that are coming due that we cannot make payment on. And we're either going to default or we're going to need a new loan from the IMF to bail us out or allow us to make the payment. What the IMF then did, and this is the second terrible thing that they have done, and critics understand this. They come in and say, well, we're not just going to give you a loan to bail you out. We are going to insist on conditions. You are going to have to make changes in your economic policies that we dictate. And this is when the IMF teams will go down to government, will go down to countries that are suffering a crisis, and they will simply negotiate certain things that government has to agree to. They have a standard package they force the governments to agree to. It's called fiscal austerity. You have to cut a bunch of spending programs. You have to increase taxes, and you have to tighten up on your own domestic money supply. Now, any macroeconomist, if you ask them, what are the predictable effects of cutting spending, raising taxes, and tightening up on the money supply, what they will tell you is that is going to send that economy in the direction of a worse recession or depression than it's already in. And these countries are already suffering from high unemployment rates, businesses that are failing, loss of production, and a drop in productive investment. These policies basically are just punitive. The IMF team, they're not ignorant. They know standard macroeconomic policy. They know what the effects of these policies are going to be. And they're not sadists. They're not gratuitously saying, we're going to punish your citizens for the fact that you got yourself in a situation, which of course we helped you get into, of being not able to pay some international creditors that you owe money to. The reason that they push those policies is those policies have the predictable effect of making it more possible for the people in that country and that country's government to pay off the creditors than they would be able to otherwise. That package of policies, those austerity conditionalities that the IMF systematically imposes every time they have come in, is essentially designed to make it more likely that every dollar that an international creditor was not going to get paid is in fact now going to be more likely to be repaid because the government is forced to follow those policies. The IMF basically is acting as the kneecappers for the mafiosos. They're basically at the service of the international lenders, and when the international lenders look like they might not get repaid, then the IMF comes in and essentially says, we're going to kneecap you. We're going to throw your economy into an even worse recession than it already is. We don't care that your people are suffering. This is the way for our people that we represent, the international lending community, to get their money back.
It's interesting that one of the things that we have fought for has been healthcare, education, and access to the essentials to life, you know, potable water, electricity, all of those things that seem like a luxury for people in third world countries that we seem to take for granted in Canada or the U.S., are things that we also had to fight for here in North America. And yet, when these austerity measures or structural adjustment policies, SAPs as they call them, come into effect to ensure those countries pay their debt, these are the first things that are put on the table. What is the cost to the nations when this happens?
It's a pure conflict of interest. It's a conflict of interest between the lenders. How much are the lenders are going to get repaid versus how much lost production, lost employment, lost government programs and services? One of the huge outcries against the IMF policy that was imposed on the Philippines in the East Asian crisis was they went down there and demanded, they said, we have to cut some of your spending programs out. Well, the Philippine government basically had a program that was a malaria prevention program. And the IMF negotiating team said, well, that's just too expensive. You can't do that. And there was a case where you could literally calculate how many people you were killing. You could predictably say, this many more people in the Philippines will die from malaria because the IMF came down and said, you're spending too much, you have to cut down your budget deficit, you've got to eliminate programs, and that's one of the ones that's going to go. This is something that we've seen over and over again in third world countries. What's new in the present environment is we're witnessing the same thing in Greece. Today I read an article about Iceland. Here are two countries that are not part of the third world who got into basically the similar kind of situation. They had their arm twisted to follow policies that allowed for borrowing and credit to operate in a way that predictably landed them. I mean, it didn't have to be Greece. It didn't have to be Iceland. But it was going to be somebody, and it turned out to be them. And they now are in a situation where they basically have unpayable debt. And the real question comes down to, when debt becomes unpayable, who is going to pay the price? Who is going to essentially, you know, who is going to pay the cost of fixing the problem that now we have an unpayable debt? And the struggle that's going on in Greece is it going to be the bankers that benefited, you know, from the good times of the borrowing binge in Greece? Is it going to be the wealthy in Greece, or is it going to be workers and public employees? Is it going to be the wealthier countries in the EU that are going to basically come in and pay the price of fixing the Greek problem, or is it going to be the poorer country in the EU? Is it going to be the citizens of Greece? That's the battle that's being fought out there. There was a wonderful article in the New York Times today about Iceland. A private bank, a private Icelandic bank, essentially sold a whole bunch of policies to 300,000 citizens in the Netherlands and in Great Britain, and that bank failed. So when the Icelandic bank system failed, you have a bank failure that's a private bank, an Iceland bank, and 300,000 foreigners essentially see their money disappear. The government of Great Britain and the government of the Netherlands came in and said, we're not going to let this happen. We are essentially going to go ahead and pay our citizens off. But now we are negotiating with the government of Iceland. We expect Iceland to pay us back. Well, there are 300,000 people in Iceland. If Iceland pays back what it is that's being demanded from them, that's $65,000 per household in Iceland. How is that going to happen? The question eventually, there's two questions people need to focus on. What are the policies that are creating these disasters? They have to be stopped. And the second thing is, when the disasters happen, inevitably the question always revolves, you know, reduces to, who's going to pay the price tag for the disaster? And then we have the fight over whether or not it's the people who benefited from it and the people who can best afford to bear a cost of fixing a problem, or whether it's simply the usual victims, the usual suspects, the people who are least powerful. It all gets shunted off on their shoulders, and of course that's the struggle that we're involved in.
In an interview with economist William Endel, he points to the deep connection of the financial system and the bankers in the U.S., and he points to the economic crisis that we are seeing being in some way directed to devalue currencies, the challenge that of the dollar. In the case of Greece, we are now hearing reports that Greece may be defaulting on its debt. What would be the impact to the European Union and the euro if this were to happen?
I actually doubt that Greece is going to default on the debt. If you look at what's transpired, they already went through a $5 billion round of fiscal austerity. That was cutting wage, eliminating some wage increases. Traditionally in Greece, there is sort of pay during vacation periods. They eliminated that. It was particularly noticeable when they decided that they were going to increase some taxes. Everybody knows in Greece that the wealthy don't pay any tax. They have loopholes that make our loopholes look, small by comparison. So there's a tremendous amount of reform that would actually be progressive reform in basically forcing wealthy people in Greece to actually pay the taxes they ought to. Instead of doing that, they raise the value-added tax, which is basically just the European version of a sales tax. Sales taxes are regressive. It means that the poorer people are paying a bigger hunk of their income in that tax than wealthier people. That's the kind of thing that's happening. So they've already imposed a $5 billion austerity program. They've just passed another $5 billion. My bet is that that will be sufficient so that Germany and the rest of the Europe will agree to go ahead and also provide them a certain amount to bail out. So I don't really think Greece is going to go bankrupt. Unfortunately, the process of Greece not going bankrupt is going to be a process that essentially requires lower-income working people to bear the brunt of the adjustment inside Greece.
I want to bring this home because you touched on something that is happening right here in British Columbia. We have a government that has invested over $6 billion in the Olympics, and most of the construction that took place was through private, what they call P3s, for private partnerships. We have the lowest corporate tax than any of the GA countries. And so I wonder if you could comment on why is it that we're unable to make that connection as citizens? Why is it that the interest...
This is purely an issue of who has the most power and who understands their self-interest most clearly and is most persistent at, pressuring lawmakers and politicians to accede to their interests. Taxes are very, very easy to understand. Progressive taxes on wealth would be the fairest taxes. Wealth taxes are few and far between. Second best is progressive taxes on income. By progressive, what is meant is if your income is higher than somebody else's, then the rate of taxation at which your income is taxed is higher than somebody else's. A low-income person pays a 10% tax rate. A high-income person pays a 30% tax rate. That's a progressive income tax. Sales taxes are notoriously regressive. Regressive means that a lower-income person will end up paying a higher percentage of their income in that tax than a higher income person. Somebody who's very, very wealthy will pay 3 or 4% of their income in sales taxes. Somebody who's very poor will end up paying 20, 30% of their income in sales taxes. Now, one really nice thing that just happened is that in the state of Washington, just this last week, the state legislature, some legislators in the Senate of the state of Washington and Olympia introduced a bill saying it's time to start an income tax here in Washington State. We have a fiscal crisis. We have students down the road that are demonstrating that they're not very happy about a 30% increase in their, in their tuition at Evergreen State College and all the other state universities in the state. Here we are in a fiscal crisis. We're being forced to make very unpopular cuts in spending programs. We need to raise taxes, and how should we do that? And one way to do it is the way the Greek government just did it. You raise the sales tax. Well, that's very, very unfair. In the case of Washington, there now is a move that they might put on the ballot for a citizens' referendum, do you want, instead of raising the sales tax, to have, for the first time in the state of Washington, an income tax? And they're proposing that the income tax only be on households that income is greater than $200,000. And that followed on the success of a referendum here in Oregon just 2 months ago, where we passed a ballot initiative, 66 and 67, that did two things. It raised the corporate tax rate, which had not been raised in Oregon since 1937. That's how ridiculous it was. We raised the corporate tax rate, and we increased taxes on households whose income were greater than $200,000. And that was a referendum, and it's hard to pass tax increase referendums. We passed that by about a 55 to 45% majority. And in Washington State, they are saying, hey, maybe this is a time for us to move forward on an agenda that we should always have had sitting there waiting for the first opportunity to make a change. In a capitalist economy, if we do not have government providing public goods, we have a system that is, it's dysfunctional to the point of being ridiculous. So there's never been a capitalist economy without a government that provides certain services that the private market system would never provide or would never provide in sufficient amounts. There's two things you always want to ask yourself. The things that the government is spending on, who's being benefited? Because there's such a thing as corporate welfare, not just welfare for, you know, the indigent and people who are disabled, et cetera. And the common belief in the United States is, oh, well, the government basically spends, you know, on poor people, and therefore if you're rich, you don't want that. Well, increasingly over the past 30 years, what the government has actually been spending on is something you could call corporate welfare. So you want to look at the spending side of every budget and see, are those the programs that are actually helping the people that most deserve to be helped? I'll throw three numbers in right here that totally caught my eye in an article just a couple of days ago. Here are our spending priorities in the United States. We spend $1 million to put a soldier in the field in Afghanistan for a year. We spend $50,000 for every prisoner in our federal prison system for a year. People have pointed out that's a Harvard education, $50,000 a year, and that's how much we spend on every prisoner in our prison system. We spend $5,000 on the taxpayer part of a year of education in a public university in the United States. There are spending priorities. When you're talking about the spending side of a budget, you want to look and see who is it that's benefiting and whether it's being spent in the ways you want to. But, of course, what's happened is corporations have lobbied more successfully to get the taxes on corporate profits eliminated. And wealthy people in the United States have done a brilliant job of lobbying, you know, their representatives that they get elected and that they give their campaign contributions to essentially just eliminate and reduce the taxes on them and to basically force those taxes onto somebody else. And sales taxes is the classic way to do it. The wealthy always try and move you away from income taxes towards sales taxes because they know that's the way to get somebody else to pay. It's a battle we should always be fighting. It's a battle that we have been losing terribly for the past 30 years. And now that the need to raise some taxes is very, very apparent, this is a time. And when people are outraged about how unfair things have been, this is the ideal time to sort of launch these kinds of campaigns. We should be more successful than we've been in the past. This is a good time to have tax fairness campaigns, and I'm very, very happy to see that one is about to take place in the state of Washington between you and me.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is economist Robin Hennell. He is the author of Economic Justice and Democracy.
Thank you very much, Sylvia.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.